Earlier this month, the Agriculture Department published a long-awaited draft rule giving guidance to food manufacturers on how to disclose foods with genetically engineered ingredients, commonly called GMOs. Food companies will have the option of including a sentence-long declaration on their packaging. Food makers will be required by federal law to use the labels starting in 2020. We're sorting through GMOs here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. But before we do, let's zoom in on the landscape of organic products. Organic food has grown into a $50 billion industry, but some Wisconsin farmers say they no longer trust that all USDA-certified producers are meeting the industry's standards. WPR's Hope Kerwin reports on how questioning the organic label could impact the industry's future.
Crunching through spring snow, Harriet Behar heads toward the high tunnel on her farm. Similar to a greenhouse, the high tunnel has heavy translucent plastic that insulates Behar's organic spinach plants from the cold.
When we start getting, 45, 50 degree days, this is just going to get huge. But you can see it's been picked all winter.
Behar says she's harvested spinach 6 or 7 times over the winter, a pretty productive crop for her farm. But when it comes to competing with hydroponic operations, where spinach is grown indoors in nutrient-filled water, Behar says it's hard for her to keep up.
It's kind of like food on steroids, because they're in a controlled environment, they don't have, wind or no sun. I mean, they're under lights. This is a big difference.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture allows hydroponic operations to be certified as organic, but farmers across the country have been debating for almost a decade whether these soilless farms really meet the standards for their industry. Behar says the problem is that hydroponics doesn't improve soil quality or protect natural resources, things that traditional organic farmers are required to document in order to be certified. Because of these exceptions and increasing reports of fraud in the industry, Behar says many producers feel the USDA organic label doesn't guarantee the same quality that it once did.
If we're certified organic and the other people are certified organic, there's no way to distinguish ourselves in the marketplace, and we think consumers care, so we're going to have this add-on label.
Called the Real Organic Project, Behar says the new label is meant to be an extension of the USDA organic seal, guaranteeing that crops are grown in soil and livestock and dairy producers are following animal welfare standards. But traditional organic farmers aren't the only ones frustrated with the National Organic Program. Some hydroponic producers, like Brian Ernst in Ripon, say they also think the organic label has lost some of its integrity.
Indoor farm is really starting to adopt a post-organic philosophy.
Ernst says when he started Ernesti Farms 4 years ago, he wanted to be certified organic. Now, he feels like the industry is commercially driven, and he doesn't think indoor farms like his need the label to be successful.
Just because customers see the USDA organic, little symbol on a clamshell, doesn't necessarily give the customer all the information they're looking for.
Some in the industry worry that if farmers continue to lose faith in the USDA seal, it could hurt the force that has made organic worth a premium. John Mesko is executive director of the Midwest Organic and Sustainable Education Service. He says the USDA does not promote organic food as being worth more than conventionally produced food.
The real value that gets added to the organic label has come from farmers, food producers and distributors, retailers, co-ops. All of those folks have been the ones promoting organic and the certified organic label as beneficial.
And Mesko says the community needs to remain united in order for organics to keep growing.
We have to proceed as a community with caution to make sure that we don't create so much confusion that we lose the momentum behind the broader organic movement.
But Harriet Behar doesn't see the Real Organic Project's add-on label as a reason for division. In fact, she's hoping it will be a rallying cry for farmers across the country.
This might be a push to the National Organic Program to improve what they're already doing, to kind of show that the organic community wants to do this, and if they're not going to do it, we're going to do it on our own.
Behar says consumers will start to see the new organic add-on label on products in 2019. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
as we continue this conversation about labels, the labeling on the products we eat, we're going to now turn toward GMOs. GMO stands for genetically modified organisms. Some people are unnerved by genetic modification in the food they eat. Let's bring in Mark Linus, who is an environment writer and a researcher at the Cornell Alliance for Science. He's the author of the new book, Seeds of Science, Why We Got It So Wrong on GMOs. He wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times called How I Got Converted to GMO Food. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, so now that we understand that GMO stands for genetically modified organism, can you go deeper for us? What are GMOs?
Well, GMO is not actually a scientifically meaningful category because every single cultivated species of crop or animal, you know, the sheep you see and the cattle, they're all genetically modified from their original wild ancestors. Otherwise, they would look very different. And in the case of crops, they would taste very different too. So everything that we eat and we see on farms is a GMO in a technical sense. But what the term generally is understood to mean is transgenic. So something which has been, where the genome has been altered in the laboratory by the insertion of DNA, a DNA sequence from a different species. So I think that's probably what people think when they say GMO, even though, of course, most people don't actually know what GMO means. They know it's something they feel a bit concerned about, and they're not really sure what the issues are.
So you're saying we humans have been experimenting with genetic modification for tens of thousands of years, but it's really only been in recent history where we've been concerned about crossing the line, crossing some line with new technology when it comes to commercial agriculture. Where did we cross the line here?
That's right. I mean, just to give you some background, the original ancestor of corn or maize was called teosinte, which is a sort of a wild bush that you can still find growing in Mexico. And that was domesticated by the indigenous Mexicans at the time. And so over many generations, they selected what we now have as corn, sweet corn. And it, of course, it's continually being changed, being altered, being genetically improved to give us the kind of modern varieties which have the high yields and the kind of succulent taste and things that people want nowadays. And genetic engineering in the sense of the GMO is really a shortcut to being able to improve the genome in a much broader variety of ways. So you could take a gene from a bacterium, which of course is actually one of the things that's happened, and put it into the corn plant and make the corn thereby resistant to insect pests. And, you know, as environmentally speaking, that gene, which is called BT from the soil bacterium, is a good thing because it means that farmers don't have to spray insecticides in the same way, because the plant itself is then resistant to the insect pest. So that's one of the environmentally beneficial uses of genetic engineering. Perhaps more controversial has been the use of Roundup Ready, which makes crops resistant to spraying of the herbicide Roundup, otherwise known as glyphosate, initially manufactured by Monsanto. And people didn't like the idea of, you know, of big machine spraying herbicide in the fields that they were going to be getting their food produce from. So I think that application of genetic engineering is probably what made the technology so controversial initially.
And we're going to get to Roundup Ready and herbicides here in just a moment, but how is genetic modification in our food today different from selective breeding or choosing parents to control for the offspring's traits? It seems like there's a bit of a gray area here.
It's all gray area, and that's the complication about this. And it's also a complication when you come to define, you know, in your previous segment, what counts as organic. Mm-hmm. You can take a crop which has been mutated via radiation mutagenesis or chemical mutagenesis. So they've done all sorts of random mutations in the crop's genome. So that's genetic engineering, but just in a sort of unintended, rather random way. Many of the crops which we use today have been treated in that way, and including organic crops. So, you know, I asked the question, in what way are they not GMOs or not genetically engineered? There's no scientifically meaningful answer. It's just that the debate hasn't grown up that way. The debate has grown up around Monsanto and around these kinds of social and political concerns. You know, it doesn't really have that much to do with genetics.
the safety of genetically modified ingredients, usually called GMOs, remains a source of tension among Americans, even as the scientific community says they pose no health risk. Many food makers right now voluntarily place no GMO on their food packaging for marketing to the consumer. And there's also some more labeling disclosure rules coming out here from the USDA. We're talking about the GMO debate here on The Morning Show. Mark Lina stays with us. He's a researcher at the Cornell Alliance for Science. His new book is called Seeds of Science, Why We Got It So Wrong on GMOs. You can join in with your questions, your perspectives on GMOs at 800-642-1234. When you're grocery shopping, do you prefer foods that are labeled no GMOs, or do you think it's just a marketing gimmick? Do you avoid the grocery store altogether and head to the farmer's market? Do you try to avoid GMOs in your diet? Why or why not? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. The term GMO stands for genetically modified organism, and it is traditionally referred to plants and animals being created by altering their genes in the lab, like inserting genetic material from one species to another. We're talking about the debate around GMOs here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Late nights, Jimmy Kimmel sent a crew to a farmer's market to see how much is known about GMOs.
What does GMO stand for?
Genetically manufactured. Oh.
What is a GMO?
A general modified ingredient, right?
What is a GMO?
It's something modified.
So there's a little late night man on the street feedback on GMOs. Environment writer Mark Lynas is with us. His new book, Seeds of Science, Why We Got It So Wrong on GMOs. And you can join in with your questions, your feelings about GMOs at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Mark, you've done a 180. You're in favor of using genetically modified crops, but that wasn't always the case. Can you tell us about your background, how you came around to GMOs?
Yeah, I guess I have done a 180, as you put it, because I used to be an anti-GMO activist. And so this was a long time ago now, back in the mid to late 1990s, I was one of those people who went out in the night and destroyed GMO test sites. We went out in, you know, full camouflage gear and chopped them down because we felt that at the time that this was a serious threat to both health and to the environment. I no longer believe that's the case, but it's been a long, long journey for me.
So why do you think that's no longer the case?
Well, I mean, it's a long story. Essentially, I became interested in the climate change issue. I wanted to inform the world about the threat of global warming, and to do that in a convincing and meaningful way, I had to really get into the science of the issue. So even though I was traveling around and I was seeing the impacts of permafrost melt and mountain glaciers disappearing and stuff like that, I also got very involved in reading the peer-reviewed science in all of these scientific journals. And I would also talk about, when I was doing debates about this issue, talk about the fact there's a scientific consensus. You may have heard 97% of the world science supports, the thesis of human-made global warming. So if you and the problem I had was, if you're going to support the scientific consensus that climate change is real, well, there's also a scientific consensus that GMOs are safe, and that the technology is potentially useful in service of environmental ends. So, I couldn't be a kind of pro-science activist or writer on climate change and an anti-science writer on the GMO issue. I felt I needed to be consistent with the scientific consensus across the board.
Let's go to the phones now with Owen joining us from Waiawiga. Hi, Owen.
Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
Okay, so I'm a farmer, and I've farmed around the country, and I know a little bit about GMOs and non-GMO crops. I also know about the certified organic label. I would need to warn the consumer, if it does not say certified organic, they're using dangerous, controlled dangerous substances like herbicides, pesticides, fungicides on these crops, no matter if they're GMO or non-GMO. Non-GMO actually uses more of the controlled dangerous substances to produce the crop because, for instance, glyphosate, Roundup Ready corn, is extremely resistant to any problems that Roundup can cause for it, and the Roundup is really good at killing anything else around it. Well, when you use a non-GMO crop, you have to use more pesticides and herbicides to kill around that crop, believe it or not, than you do when you're using a Roundup Ready type corn. But either way, the consumer has to understand this is an attempt to try to undermine the organic label and the certification of organic crops that do not use pesticides, chemicals, fertilizers, any type of controlled dangerous substances on the crop. Unless it says certified organic, it's not really going to be safe.
Owen, I'm going to stop you right there because you bring up some really great points to dig into. Mark, first of all, labeling. Where is labeling at with GMOs as well as the organic labels?
Well, there's a different system in different countries, different jurisdictions. So the USA has a government mandated organic labeling system. In Europe, where I'm talking to you from, and in the UK, that tends to be done by independent certification bodies, of which there's several competing ones. So there's always a debate, really, about what organic actually means. And it's slightly a myth that there's no pesticides of any sort used in organic farming. I mean, they can be used, but they just have to be considered natural. So you could have copper sulfate, which is often used as a fungicide by organic farmers growing grapes or other things which are susceptible to blight and other diseases. Of course, there's also fertilizer use, but that fertilizer brings in nitrates. So it's the same chemistry, but it has to be brought in from animal manures or from other natural sources. So, you know, plants are the same. They need protection from pests. They need protection from diseases. They need to be protected from competition by weeds, and they need to be fertilized. They need water. So, you know, what farmers are doing is trying to make the best of a situation using whatever production system they've chosen.
So the USDA has just proposed a draft rule that would require labeling for some products containing genetically modified ingredients. And the proposed label, it doesn't use the phrase GMO. They use the phrase biologically engineered, or the abbreviation B. So what's your opinion on that? Do you think genetically modified foods should be labeled?
I'm actually pro-labeling, which you might find strange from somebody who's spoken positively about GMOs, because I do believe that the consumer has a right to know, essentially, and also that people will, you know, make good decisions when they're properly informed. And what you don't want is a situation where people think that something's being done to their food and they're not allowed to know about it. You know, that breeds suspicion and it breeds hostility. So transparency across the food chain, and as much as that's achievable, has got to be a good thing. With regard to the USDA labeling proposals, these came out of the GMO labeling law, which was signed by President Obama back in 2016. And what they're trying to do is to get away from the whole stigma of GMO. So they don't want to put a kind of GMO symbol on a, you know, on a packet of some food produce, because that's sort of the equivalent to a skull and crossbones. So they want to provide the information without having the scaremongering and the fearmongering, if you like, that tends to go along with it. So I think they're looking for a compromise. This doesn't please the anti-GMO people, because they've got a sort of smiley sun face and a bioengineered symbol, and no one really knows what that means. But you've got to have some way of also just making a distinction between different types of GMOs. They're not all the same thing. You know, Roundup Ready is very different to BT insect resistant, which is very different to, say, the Hawaiian papaya, which is resistant to a virus. You know, that's got nothing to do with Roundup Ready. So just putting the same GMO labeling in it is also misleading. But people do need to know what they're eating, and they do need to be able to make choices for themselves.
So the environmental risks and the health effects of Roundup Ready crops that's not clear yet. And so where is the research on this today? What do we know about GMOs and the health risks associated with Roundup Ready crops?
Are you asking me that?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, there's no risk about the crops themselves. So a GMO crop is the same as any other crop in terms of health. That's what the scientists are very clear on. There is some debate about the potential health impacts of Roundup itself. So glyphosate, which is the chemical, which is the active ingredient in that particular herbicide, it's certainly less toxic than many of the herbicides that farmers were using before, like dicamba, atrazine. There's other herbicides. Don't imagine that before GMO Roundup Ready came along, farmers were not spraying their fields. They were, absolutely. And they were spraying more toxic things, often just in different combinations. So it's a complicated picture. And the debate about glyphosate or Roundup comes about because the IARC, which is an agency of the World Health Organization, did suggest that that Roundup was potential human carcinogen. Now, there's lots of other ones like bacon, red meat. Those are also classed as potential carcinogens. So and those are things you actually eat. So you need to put this kind of thing in context. But there's still certainly a debate about the potential health impacts of glyphosate going on in the scientific community.
We're talking with Mark Lynas, who is an environmental writer, about the conversation surrounding GMOs, past, present, future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think foods with genetically modified ingredients should be labeled? Have you changed your opinion about GMOs? What made you change? What made you evolve? Do you think there should be concern around GMOs? Is it well-founded, or do these concerns overlook the science on the issue? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go back to the phones now with Bill waiting in Wanakee. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is a good topic. I'm glad you guys are talking about it. I want to say first, I'm not an anti-GMO guy, so just want to get that out there. The other thing I said, I want to clarify, that the line is for most GMO, anti-GMO people, the line is very thick and bold, and it's not a gray area. There's laboratory genetically modified crops and crossbreeds. Crossbreeds are fine. It's been happening for thousands of years. Nobody is opposed to crossbreeding, not that I know of. And transgenics, as you mentioned before, you said it once, but I want to make it clear, and so everybody hears, it's the laboratory modified organics that are a concern. And please do not convolute this argument. It's a very clear-cut argument. I want to say that my concern with GMOs is with monocropping and blight resistance, and I think that's a lot bigger concern than the health effects. I worry about what we're doing to our genetic diversity in our cropping.
And Bill, you just cut off there. So we're concerned about monocropping and blight resistance there. Mark Lynas.
Yeah, I know that monocropping is a concern for a lot of people.
Monocropping?
It's a difficult thing to define usefully, but the idea, I suppose, that lots of the same crop variety are being grown in a single place. But really, that's the only way to do modern agriculture. If you're going to use a combine harvester, if you're going to use big machinery, if you're going to harvest, tens, hundreds, thousands of acres of a single crop. Which is what you need to do if you're going to do this cost-effectively, then you have to have the same thing grown. You can't have a corn plant and a wheat plant and a tomato plant all next to each other. I mean, you can do that in your back garden, in your yard, or even on a small-scale family farm or small holding. You can have that kind of diversity, but the cost of production is much, much higher. That's why things are more expensive in the farmers market. And I'm a supporter of farmers markets. I think it's great that they exist, but you can't feed the whole population at the level of cheap food that people have come to expect, and do that in that way without having these very large economies of scale that you have in modern agriculture.
Let's go to Patrick now in Richland County. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, good morning, and great show. Monocropping, that's when you drive to Illinois and it's horizon to horizon. Like corn, there's not even a tree for a raccoon to climb. But anyway.
I like your definition, Patrick. Very nice.
Well,
very colorful.
Christmas is scary. If you drive through it, it's like this is hopeless. Anyway, back to GMOs. Gluten intolerance mean you can't eat wheat. I'm one of them. I can't eat wheat anymore. I used to eat a loaf of homemade bread a day, shredded wheat and all that. It's been quite a change in the diet, thankfully. There's quite a bit of food out there that's GMO or gluten-free. Anyway, the medical community cannot figure out what causes that. They know that we're allergic to the wheat, but and they know that it's something that's been altered in the wheat. They're not sure. They haven't determined that yet. So isn't that nature's way of saying, look, this grain has been in humanity probably longer than any grain. And now all of a sudden, if you eat it, your body rejects it like a poison. Now, and your guest is saying, oh, GMOs are great, they're great, they're great. So reassure me that this is not GMOs is the reason I can't eat some of my favorite foods anymore.
Oh, Patrick, thanks for calling in. Mark Linus, what do you make of that?
Well, I can reassure your caller very quickly because there are no GMO wheats available to consumers anywhere in the world. There is no GMO wheat being grown on any farm in any country. So that is not the issue. The issue with gluten is that there's a particular protein which celiac people are allergic to, and perhaps a large number of people have some form of gluten intolerance. And actually, you know, people are suspicious about what goes on in laboratories, but with the new techniques of gene editing, it's looking like it's going to be possible to make wheat, which people can digest who are gluten intolerant, by taking out that one protein. So, you know, modern science can potentially solve this problem, and it certainly hasn't caused it in the way that your caller was suggesting. Gluten intolerance has been around for a lot longer, but I think we've only recently discovered what's going on and given it a name.
So, Mark Linus, the Supreme Court of India this week declined to stay a high court order that invalidated Monsanto's patent for its genetically modified cottonseed. So it brings us to a legal question about intellectual property and genetically modified plants. How much do patents and intellectual property have to do with what's in our food?
Well, intellectual property as a whole is a way in which innovators and inventors reclaim their investment. And if you invent a new product, whether it's an iPhone or a new computer or really anything, you want a intellectual property rights or patent gives you a monopoly ownership of that for a period of time so that you can recoup your investment. Otherwise, anyone can just copycat it and steal the technology. So that's the whole point of intellectual property. The debate is whether that should be applicable in seeds. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed that it should be, and therefore farmers aren't allowed to save and replant seeds of patented genes. And that's been, you know, that's been controversial. You know, I think personally, I prefer to have an open source approach, and I'd rather have more of the genetic engineering being done in the public sector so that we could do things which are not necessarily just servicing the interests of big commercial companies. And, you know, what's happening in India is interesting, actually, because the Indian government is essentially trying to appropriate Monsanto's technology on behalf of its farmers. And I guess good luck to them, but they probably won't have Monsanto coming back in with the new varieties when they've got them ready for the market and they want to take them into other countries. So there's always that kind of balance to be struck, really. If you take away intellectual property rights, then you're not going to get the innovation and the invention, but you might have the technology more useful to more people at a lower price.
It's kind of like open source computing in a way. What might be pretty similar is what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think the open source model is a good one. You know, we didn't, you know, if you were concerned about the monopoly of, I don't know, Microsoft Windows back in the day, you didn't try and ban computers like the anti-GMO people seem to want to do. You pushed for open source and you went to Linux, whatever it was. And, you know, that's the right kind of model. And there's no reason why that can't be applied in genetics as well. These technologies are now very available. You know, high school kids can do it. You can do it in your garage. You know, for me, that's much more positive than having the whole thing locked up in big corporations.
Major food manufacturers have fought long and expensive battles against GMO labeling. They've been worried that they would deter customers, and under USDA guidelines, organic foods may not contain genetically engineered ingredients. We're exploring the debate around GMOs here in the U.S. on The Morning Show. Author Mark Linus is our guide. His new book is called Seeds of Science, and he recently wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times called How I Got Converted to GMO Food. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you come down on GMOs? We'll get back to the discussion after this latest news here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about GMOs here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for joining us. The proposed guidelines out this month by the USDA propose labels that say bioengineered or B. Food makers would be given a choice of three disclosure methods, spelling out the information, as in contains a bioengineered food ingredient, using a standard icon, smiley face has been going around, or applying a QR code that directs consumers to a website with more information. Mark Linus stays with us for this conversation surrounding GMOs. Your thoughts in the mix at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to the phones now with Caitlin joining us from Spring Green. Hi, Caitlin.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to make the comment that I work in soil and water conservation, and with the development of Roundup Ready crops, we're actually able to see dramatically reduced or no tillage land, especially on our steep lands here in the Driftless area of southwest Wisconsin, and that allows us to see lower soil erosion and actually increase our water quality with responsible use of GMOs. Thank you.
So Caitlin, you're saying with more responsible use of GMOs, there are significant environmental benefits?
Yeah, from a soil erosion standpoint, when we don't have to do repeat tillage to go in and weed, we're able to just do a single herbicide pass, which does not disturb the soil as much.
Mark Linus, what do you make of that in terms of the soil quality?
Yeah, that's very well demonstrated that there's been a huge increase in no-till and conservation agriculture, and that's been assisted by the advent of Roundup Ready crops. So as your caller was just saying, previously, as well as spraying different herbicides, farmers would have to take a cultivator through the crop in order to hoe down the weeds, essentially. That means disturbing the soil, and also before sowing the soil with new seeds, there would always be plowing, so they'd be turning the soil over. That leads to more soil and wind erosion, so you tend to lose topsoil that way. So plowing is something that a lot of arable farmers are trying to get out of, and Roundup Ready makes that more easy to do. You can just drill seeds through the residue of the previous year's crop, and then just, with one or two passes, spray down the weeds that come up with the Roundup Ready, because you've got the crop with the Roundup Ready trait. So that's what I was saying about how it's complicated. Even though consumers and a lot of the environmental groups don't like Roundup and they don't like GMOs in general, the science is quite clear that it has helped with soil conservation and has helped protect the carbon stocks in the soil as well. So that's even a climate change benefit.
Caitlin, thanks. Let's go to Mabel now, joining us from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Mabel.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My comments aren't so much about the GMO, but about he touched on the glyphosate of Roundup. And I'm just alarmed with that stuff because it's so poisonous to the environment. And people that work with it, a lot of them are getting kidney cancer and lymphomas. And this glyphosate is poisoning the water. The 51 major river basins and streams in the United States are polluted with that. When you see these green algae, and like in Lake Erie you had a couple years ago, that's from all this farm runoff of glyphosate, and it's killing all the insects. And I did a study specifically on monarch butterflies. In the 1990s, there were over a billion of them left. 2009, they were down to 45 million. When they did the count in 2013-2014, they were down to 25 million. The reports from Mexico, where they go to hibernate for the winter, they dropped another 14.8%. They are so much in jeopardy that they might even lose their migration. And I just think this is the wrong thing to do because farmers were not supposed to be using totally herbicides, but the government let them use them on a helpful basis back after World War II.
Mabel, let's get Mark to respond there. Mabel, bringing up glyphosate and what it does to the environment.
Yeah, I mean, there was a few things mentioned there. It's not true that glyphosate affects insects directly. It's a herbicide, not an insecticide. So it doesn't touch insects. It kills broadleaf plants. That's what it's intended to do, and it targets a particular amino acid pathway, which doesn't exist in animals. So That's not quite right. It's not quite right either that it's causing algal blooms in Lake Erie and other places and in river systems. That comes from fertilizers, so it comes from nitrogen and phosphate. So that's a different issue really altogether. There is some connection with monarch butterflies probably because Roundup Ready has made it possible for farmers to control weeds much more effectively than they were doing before. So milkweed, which is the main food for monarch butterflies, has absolutely been decimated from the fields because they're now growing much more corn. So that's one of the, you know, farmers are always trying to get rid of weeds, but those weeds are food for something. And in this case, they're food for monarch butterflies. So there's now programs to try and bring back milkweed, at least in targeted areas, so that these poor butterflies do actually have something to feed on. Otherwise, it is going to be difficult to protect the migration of what is such an iconic and really a wonderful emblematic species.
Mabel, appreciate it. Let's go to Andrew now in Pulaski. Andrew, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on this morning.
Sure.
So I'm a microbial and biochemical ecologist, but I'm also a farmer. And I grew up in northeast Wisconsin where cows outnumber humans. And what I've seen is that the farmers that are growing food for the cows are growing corn and soybeans, GMO foods, that are destroying the soils around us and creating health effects downstream that are causing major issues. If you want to have a real soil erosion protection, you want to have real environmental capability, you want to be able to put the cows on grass. That's what they eat. Let them eat that, and then it'll keep all their nutrients in. You don't have to worry about spraying Roundup Ready crops. You don't have to worry about spraying anything.
So, Andrew, you've seen us try to become way too sophisticated in how we engineer food.
Yeah, and if we're going to do that, why not be proud of it? Why not? Why are you afraid to put the label, we're genetically engineered? Be proud of it. Same with the CAFOs. Why shouldn't we be proud that we're doing it that way?
Andrew, thanks for the call. Mark Linus, how can consumers educate themselves when we approach GMOs? How can we go about making sure we understand?
Well, the problem you've got is there's so many different things going on here. So your caller was just talking about animal production and CAFOs, you know, aka factory farms. And of course, there's huge welfare issues there that you don't want to think of your animals penned up or, you know, without any access to the outside world. But it is also a more efficient way to produce beef and pork and so on. And so it uses less input. So you could make an environmental argument that goes against the animal welfare argument. So there's all these different kinds of trade-offs. And I was saying for Roundup Ready, you know, it can help protect the soil, but at the same time, you're going to be using glyphosate. So, you know, which is better, which is worse? People tend to go for organic. But then organic, because the yields are lower, because they can't have artificial fertilizers, they can't use the same kinds of farming systems that most modern farmers use, they have lower yields. And that means to grow the same amount of food to feed the population, you need to cultivate more land. And that can mean, you know, destroying biodiversity somewhere else. So all the problem is with any kind of simple labeling system that all these issues are very complicated. And, you know, what's the consumer to do? You'd stand in the supermarket aisle just being completely baffled and not knowing what to do. So it is the problem with all of these things is that just having a simple one-off label saying GMO, I don't think solves any of these problems. Because it doesn't distinguish between them. So you need to try to increase people's access to information across the food chain, and people can make hopefully as informed decisions as possible when they're making their buying choices.
You say the word trade-offs, and what concerns you about the way the industrialized world gets its food today?
Well, clearly there's huge environmental problems resulting from large-scale farming. You just have to go to the Gulf of Mexico and see the dead zones, you know, to see what the downstream impacts are of the U.S. Corn Belt. What concerns me a lot also is the use of ethanol, so the fact that a lot of the corn crop is diverted to basically put into cars, I don't think that's a good use of what could potentially be human food. But actually what concerns me more is the food security in developing countries. You know, we've not talked about GMOs in Africa, but there are so many different possibilities that can really help some of the poorest farmers in the world get better crops in really, really difficult droughts, you know, disease situations. And I visited some of these places myself in Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania quite recently. And they're facing, unfortunately, all the same arguments from the anti-GMO people saying these farmers should never use this stuff. But the reality is that if they were able to use it, it would potentially be a help in feeding their families. So let's not export these kinds of first world, you know, concerns of well-fed people to countries where people don't currently have enough to eat.
Oh, so you have evolved as you look at the global picture. As you travel to Africa, you see food scarcity and also see where GMOs could really help the food chain and accessibility?
Right. In Uganda at the moment, for example, people eat this food called matoke, which is a steamed green banana, which is mashed up a bit like mashed potato or corn. And that's the staple food. But these bananas are being devastated by a bacterial disease, which is just spreading throughout the country. There is a GMO solution in the offing using a couple of genes from sweet pepper. And the field trials have been very promising. But the problem is the farmers can't get hold of these improved crops, which are disease resistant, because the anti-GMO people have convinced parliamentarians that it's going to give everyone cancer or whatever, you know, all of these kinds of myths that get put around. So the impact of anti-GMO activism in Africa is very pernicious, and I really think it's harming people, harming the interests of some of the poorest people in the world.
So as we wrap up here, the debate over GMOs in this part of the world, here in the U.S., is often really polarizing. How do you think both sides could do a better job of listening to each other and actually moving the GMO conversation forward?
Well, I think that's absolutely key. I've even myself proposed a sort of peace treaty where we can try and find some areas of common ground between all of these people who are campaigning on different aspects of the food debate, particularly on the GMO issue. But, you know, we all want to see less pesticides, less chemicals used in agriculture. But at the same time, we also want to see more productivity so that we can keep the rainforests and keep the wetlands and keep the natural ecosystems from being plowed under as the world population grows. So, again, it comes down to trade-offs, but let's try and make sure that that people have enough to eat all over the world, including in Africa, and that we do that in a way which also makes agriculture more environmentally friendly.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Mark Lynas is a researcher at the Cornell Alliance for Science, author of the new book, Seeds of Science, Why We Got It So Wrong on GMOs. He also has an opinion piece in the New York Times called How I Got Converted to GMO Food. This hour of the morning show was produced by Colleen Leahy and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation about GMOs, you find it on the Ideas Network.